God aften og velkommen til Radio Shalom. Vi sender på 87,6 MHz på FM-båndet og på http://radioshalom.dk. Jeres vært og tekniker denne aften, Alexander Mikdagslav. I aftenens program lytter vi til holocaustforskeren Jan Grabowski. Vi lytter til et foredrag, der tager udgangspunkt i bogen Night Without End, der har en undertitel The Fates of Jews in Selected Counties of Occupied Poland. Bogen udkom sidste år i engelsk oversættelse. Det er et kæmpe værk på to bind på næsten 900 sider hver, som Jan Grabowski er medudgiver af og har skrevet et af kapitlerne på knap 200 sider. Hvem er så Jan Grabowski? Ja, Jan Grabowski er polsk-jødisk historiker fra Warszawas Universitet. Han forlader Polen og rejser til Canada et år før kommunismens sammenbrud. Han får Ph.D. i Montreal og er i dag professor på Universitetet i Ottawa med særlig fokus på det sprængfarlige emne om forholdet mellem polske jøder og polakker i det nazi-besatte Polen under 2. verdenskrig. Jan Grabowskis forskning og bøger, som har vakt beundring og skaffet ham udmærkelser, har også skaffet ham mange fjender, især i de polske højre nationale kredse. Men ikke kun. Grabowskis konklusioner stemmer nemlig meget dårligt overens med de fleste polakkers selvopfattelse som krigens heltemodige ofre og jødernes redningsmænd. En narration, de blev fodret med lige siden krigens afslutning. Grabowskis forskning viser snarest det modsatte af, hvad de fleste polakker ved eller vil vide om de mørke sider af Polens historie. Hans forskning viser netop mange polakkers velvillige medvirken til jødeudryddelserne, noget som i Polen anses for en uretfærdig antipolsk anklage og bagvaskelse. Trusler på livet er noget, som Jan Grabowski har siden måttet lære at leve med, lige så vel han må leve med truslen om en retslig forfølgelse i Polen. Hans forskning, hans bøger og konklusioner gør, at han er på kanten til at forbrøde sig mod den gældende lovgivning om, hvordan Polens krigshistorie må fremstilles. Lovgivningen blev indført for 3-4 år siden af den nuværende polske kvasi-fascistiske regering, og der vanker op til 3 eller 5 års fængsel, jeg kan ikke rigtig huske det præcis, hvis man ikke er makkerat. Ja, Polen i dag har en lov om, hvad der er sandt eller usandt i polsk historie. Så meget om demokratiets tilstand i det land. Men tilbage til Jan Grabowski. Hans foredrag, det efterfølgende interview og diskussion med publikum, fandt sted på det historiske museet i Stockholm den 7. november 2022. For arrangementet stod Jødisk Kultur i Sverige, The Institute for Holocaust Research in Sweden. Udsendelsen er på engelsk.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Historiska Museet in Hörsalen. My name is Lizzie Shea. I am the director of Jüdisch Kultur in Sverige. This event, this talk with Professor Jan Grabowski and Professor Karin Quist-Gevert is arranged by the Institute for Holocaust Studies, the Institute for Holocaust Research in Sweden, the newly established actually, maybe Karin will say a few more words about it. Yeah. Karin is the director of that institute, and together with Jewish Culture in Sweden, we're very happy to welcome you to this afternoon talk, and especially happy to have with us Professor Jan Grabowski. Professor Jan Grabowski was a guest with Karin. We had an online talk about a year and a half ago, also on his book Night Without End, which will be discussed this afternoon.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say too many words. I'm just going to say that we're very happy to be able to arrange this on an afternoon.
Perfect.
And I wish you a meaningful talk, both Karin and Jan. And we will then open the floor to question from you if you want to discuss further with Karin and Jon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, and warmly welcome all of you who have found your way here to Historiska Museet today, and welcome to this book talk with Professor Jon Grabowski. And as Lizzie was saying, it's a co-arrangement in between the IHRS, the Institute for Holocaust Research in Sweden, and Judisk Kultur I Sverige, Jewish Culture in Sweden. The IHRS was established to initiate and conduct comprehensive research on all aspects concerning the Holocaust, focused on material and topics relevant to Sweden. It is financed by a non-profit foundation of Joel and Ulrika Citron. And my name is Karin Kvist-Geverts. I'm an associate professor in history and the director of the IHRS, and I will moderate this book talk today. The IHRS and Judisk Kultur I Sverige are very honored to have you here, Professor Jon Grabowski, as our guest today. Welcome. It's okay. Go ahead. Jon Grabowski is a professor of history at the University of Ottawa and a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. His interests focus on Holocaust in Poland and more specifically on the relations between Jews and Poles during the war. Professor Grabowski's book, Hunt for the Jews, Betrayal and Murder in German-occupied Poland, was awarded the Yad Vashem International Book Prize of 2014. His most recent book on duty, The Role of the Polish Blue Police in the Holocaust, has been published in Poland in March of 2020. In 2018, Jon Grabowski co-edited and co-authored the book Dalej jest noc, Night Without End, together with Professor Barbara Engelking. The book was published as two volumes in Polish, and now for all of us who don't read Polish, we should really, really read Polish, but we don't. So we're very happy that the book is now out in English in September of this year under the title Night Without End, The Fate of the Jews in German-occupied Poland. And it's published by Yad Vashem and the Indiana University Press. It is an impressive effort of research made by 8 scholars, and Professor Grabowski will give us an insight into what that such detailed studies can tell us when it comes to reconstructing the daily reality of the genocide, and talk about how county studies can contribute to historiography and to our understanding of the Holocaust. We've said 2 hours, but 2 hours is a little long, we think. So Professor Grabowski will talk for about 40 minutes, present the main findings and methods and similar of the book. And then we will have a brief talk, and then there will be a chance for you to also to engage and ask questions for Professor Grabowski. So, without further ado.
Well, thank you very much, Karin, for this invitation, and thank you for being here. I understand that making yourself available on a Monday early afternoon is not always obvious, so I very much appreciate your presence, and I am delighted to be able to bring my book and to tell you a bit about the research surrounding this book and items covered. Can I just go on? Okay, very well. And I enjoy very much each moment that I spend in your lovely city, which I came to appreciate 3 years actually ago, just before the pandemic started. So I have fond memories of times when life was still simple, I guess. So thank you once again for this invitation. Thank you for being here. A few words. Now, this book actually, I could now at this stage write perhaps not a book, but a long article about the fate of this book, which is a sort of rather silly, because books should speak for themselves. In this case, however, due to political situation in Poland. The book has acquired a life of its own, which had little to do with what has been written, with what the book presented. Book became simply a focal point of huge campaign of hate steered by the Polish authorities. People who really didn't have any idea what has been written by the authors, but who reacted to code words in a way which was very hostile. But I'm not here to talk about the politics surrounding Holocaust research in Eastern Europe, specifically in Poland, rather to look at the book itself. And what you have in English, in Polish, it's more detailed. As you heard, there was the when I tried to have this book published in the United States, when potential editors, her publishers, heard about two volumes of highly academic work, they sort of drifted away. Therefore, I believe this English edition is highly readable if you can actually make your way through a lot of human misery, but that's part of the package. So what you have here is a sort of a new, I would say, without false modesty, to an extent, pathfinding work, which wants to look, if when you read the history of the Holocaust, especially in Eastern Europe, where the event actually took place in a major way, right? I mean, you have to remember that the fundamental question is, why should we really bother studying Holocaust in Poland? It's not only the question of numbers, but it's a question of volume, definitely, too. You need to remember that out of 6 million Jews who were put to death during the Holocaust, 5 million, nearly 5 million, found their death on the territory of pre-war Polish Republic. If you look at the fact that over 3 million, more than 3 million victims of the Holocaust were actually carrying Polish passports, more than a half. It renders study of this phenomenon all the more important. And something that I find extraordinary, also hard-hitting, is that when I ask, for instance, my students teaching on the Holocaust, I ask, tell me how many, what was the percentage of Polish Jews who survived the Holocaust, Jews who found themselves under the Nazi boot? There are various responses, but the correct one is 1.5%. So imagine the extraordinary completeness of the Holocaust. If we were here, a group of Polish Jews, probably no one would have left this room alive. So all of these things come to mind when you start to do the research. And my own thinking when I came to this project, when I initiated this project, and I brought together a group of scholars who wanted to embark upon this journey 6 years prior to its publication. We started in 2012. One of my main objectives was to go beyond this casual words that are so often repeated, which is many, some. I really wanted to try to ask myself a question, how many? If we say that many people persecuted the Jews, I would like to know how many, and that the Jews were most successful at doing this or that. I would like to see some statistics. So what this book tries, hopefully with a degree of success, to do is to convey the quality, but also quantity. So this is a study which has its own quantitative underpinning, about which I will say a few words later on. So what you look here at are counties, which is the reason is you cannot really describe in any detail Holocaust in its enormity in Poland. It cannot be done. If you want to, you can do it, but on a very shallow level. So if you want to go deep, if you want to try to assign these values that I mentioned, you need to limit your scope. At the same time, you want to make it somehow, well, historian has to be able to generalize, otherwise local studies have no sense. So for me, this lesson was when I published in 2011 a book which Karin mentioned, which later on was translated into several other languages, but I was looking at one county, accidental county, county I really did not plan to look at, and so I published a book, but the immediate criticism, which I sort of agreed with, is how much can we gather from, understand from one county, which is few thousand Jews, 60 to 80,000 non-Jews. It gives you some kind of a let's say statistical mass or a mass or horizon of human misery. But I was told by sometimes very hostile readers that, of course, you do not dare to go beyond the phenomenon you described because it might not be representative. Therefore, the idea is if you want more, we will deliver more. How many more? Well, it's limited by, of course, resources. This project has been done on a shoestring budget, partially funded by the generosity of Canadian taxpayer in their innocence, and partially by some other grants. But the thing is that it was a project on a shoestring budget and basically relying on something I call organized enthusiasm or sometimes disorganized enthusiasm. Important thing is that these 8 studies that you see here are, I really tried with my co-editor to do it very, very precisely, that they reflect the same methodology. It's not that you have all these ideas switching from one county to another. So what you have are areas which are spread from the northeast of Poland to the southeast of Poland, covering areas which were densely, before the war, densely populated by Jewish population. This is the former Pale of Settlement that you know of. Please interrupt me whenever you want. Okay. So what you see are these, now we focused, and it was a deliberate decision, we focused on rural areas. Now why? Because one thing is that we are more or less familiar with the areas of with huge ghettos, with large ghettos. They have been studied to an extent. And two-thirds or more of Polish Jews were dwelling in those small shtetls. They were, the Jewish life was very much a, we can call it a rural provincial phenomenon. Big cities were exception rather than a rule. So we looked at this small provincial scenario, and we were looking altogether. In this book you will find evidence of 110,000 Jews, which is already a sizable population, spread, as I mentioned, from northeast to southeast. 110,000 Jews, and we were looking mostly, there is always an introduction before the war, early period of war, but our target was, and this is something I was really very adamant about, was to start this detailed, in-depth description and research with the so-called Liquidierungsaktionen. And I don't know how to say it, because you know normally when you are a specialist in the history of a given theme period, you more or less anticipate what you are going to find. It's inevitable. It's very rare to have sudden surprise of major proportions, which tends to change the way you actually look at the history of your period. Well, this is something which happened to me on a smaller scale during writing the previous book, and much larger when I read, when I was reading the manuscripts from, so to say, my authors and my own research. And this was, to be honest, the phenomenon of complete and utter horrible isolation of dying Jews. I asked my colleagues who were working with me to pay particular attention to the moment of liquidation of the ghettos. In each and every county of our choice, we had 2 to 3 small ghettos. I asked them to do something called, and I did it myself, triangulation of memory. So it is, well, what you do is, you, for your limited area, you go to the archives in Israel, in Germany, in Poland. You look at the survivors' testimonies. You look at all possible evidence, which is immense. If you look only in Poland, at the, and we relied heavily on Polish archives here, on literally millions of pages of so-called August trials, which were post-war trials against people suspected of collaboration with Germans. These court cases came to light very recently. They have been made accessible 15 years ago, perhaps. They are a major source of information. So when you triangulate this Polish memory, Jewish survivor memory with Jewish non-survivor memory, and actually you have to remember that 99% of Jews who entered this horrifying situation did not have a chance to leave their testimony, right? Which of course we need to remember all the time, that the Jewish memory is based on a partial record of people who were extraordinary, you can say, lucky. They were the chosen ones. But we tried to go after the evidence left behind also by the dead. There is a lot of it, direct and indirect as well. And then you have the German memory. Those of you who know these things know that there is a huge huge archive in Ludwigsburg, for instance, where you can find the records of German courts investigating without much enthusiasm Nazi crimes in the 1960s and 1970s. But there is a lot of in other German archives too, and Yad Vashem, of course, as well. So what we were looking at really closely was the moment, as I call it, when the Jewish lives stopped, lost their entire value in the eyes of the outside world. And this moment I could pinpoint with a large degree of certainty. It happened during the liquidation of these ghettos. The thing is that usually when you go, for instance, to our, and we show it in each and every chapter, this is a horrifying journey through absolutely catastrophic horrors, because you have, this Holocaust starts at this point, let's say. It starts in plain sight of everybody. There are no bystanders. Everyone is somehow implicated. If you are a German or Ukrainian guards or the auxiliaries, you are simply committing mass murder. If you are and degrees of complicity, which are described here, this was something that actually triggered extraordinary, let's say, anxiety and then hate on the part of Polish authorities. What we had to report was basically the multitude of non-Jewish, in this case mostly Polish, also sometimes Belarusian or Ukrainian, actors, so previously called as bystanders, who joined the German genocidal plan for a variety of reasons that we can discuss later on. But the thing is that you can see that this German project found willing adherents, found willing people. And the whole process is being described in this detail, and you can see that the German project was open to, let's say, bottom-up initiatives. In other words, what you have the less the Germans have forces in the area, they are spread very thin on the ground, Germans. They have some police battalions, they have some members of their police, but they have actually to use the locals in a variety. The less, generally speaking, the less the Germans are present in an area, the greater role will go to these non-traditional actors, be it Poles, Ukrainians, or Belarusians, who are on the pages of this book. So one thing is the description of this action, the day at the, imagine one day, these liquidations of small ghettos rarely took more than one day. These ghettos have between 2,000 and 5,000 or 6,000 Jewish inmates. And during one day of this orgy of violence, which is intended to crush any will of the Jews to rebel, to oppose, to do anything. It's, and the second thing is to prove to the outside world, to the bystanders, don't do anything stupid because you see what happens to the Jews. Now, what we found also, which was new, one of these findings that was for me very new, was that there were actually ghettos that we described were 50% of local Jews have been murdered in situ during the liquidation of the ghetto. So when you hear an account that blood was flowing in the streets, it's not a poetic license. Blood was actually flowing in the streets. And I found a paper trail, so to say, of written by a sanitation department of a small town to a municipal council. They wanted reimbursement because they had to put sand on the sidewalks in order to cover simply blood. So this horror has not been described before, not in this kind of detail, with the kind of how many Jews, what they did, what the, our focus was the Jews. How these people reacted, what was their big word, strategy, how they wanted to survive, what they did. So this is a harrowing research, I have to tell you. It's not an easy reading, but much worse is, of course, digging your way through it. So this is one part of it. Just interrupt me at any moment. Because I can go on and on. No, so the thing is that we describe these aktionen in very big detail, and then, and this is something I call for, well, and I hope it takes. I call it the first phase of Holocaust in Poland is the initial anti-Jewish measure is the ghettoization. This is roughly 1939 through the end of 1941. Now, 1942, but the chronology is here, of course, flexible and fluid, in flux. The second period is the period of liquidations of the ghettos. It can last from March 1942 to March 1943, depending on the area. The Germans have their own map, so to say, of liquidations. Sometimes they do it in three stages. In any case, so the second part is, I call it the period of liquidations, which is this horrifying period that's described here. And the third period is something I call Hunt for the Jews, and this one goes until the very end of German presence in each and every area. And we focus, having described these aktionen, we look at the third period. Most, the bulk of our writing will be about the third period, because we know what happened to about 90% of Jews from the ghettos. They have been either killed in situ, or they have been deported, or they have been deported to Treblinka, to Bełżec, to other death sites. So then we had to calculate how many tried or succeeded in fleeing. And this is actually we came up with the number which confirmed Jewish survivor accounts to an extent, which posited that around 10% of Polish Jews made it into the extra, let's say, outside the ghetto's world, and they confronted very hostile climate outside. So we're looking at Acción, and then we look at what happens to people who had this working chance at survival. Because another thing is that, and this is quite obvious, that once these Jews fled the ghettos, from the point of view of the Germans, they became largely invisible. Once they shed their, let's say, religious clothing, they had, or very few of them did, from the point of view of the Germans, they became simply parts of a rural population. And the things at this stage, at the stage of Judenjagd, of this hunt for the Jews, the association or the help of local elements was absolutely crucial from the German point of view. And this is what we study. So on the one hand, we look at the variety of ways in which the Jews want to survive, which is the most plain one or the obvious one is to try to pretend you are someone else. Now you can do it if you know very well Polish, if your Polish is not accentuated. So we list all these things which you have to be aware, for instance, if you have curly dark hair, you have to straighten them somehow. If you have an accent, you are probably as good as dead. If you have, the problem is also quite clear that the Jews, having been for 2 to 2.5 years inside ghettos, undergoing horrifying level of violence and hunger, they oozed fear. In other words, one of the initial things we describe here are the tactics of people who look for these Jews, hunting them down. They look for people who are afraid of their own shadow. So if you want to survive, you have to pretend that you are actually, you have to be an actor, a wonderful actor actually, or you go into hiding. And that means that's another choice, or you can flee to Germany, trying to pretend that you are a forced laborer. In Germany, actually, ironically, Polish Jews were much more successful at surviving in Germany as slave laborers than they were in hiding in Poland. So,
and this had to do also with the Polish, with the neighbors and the behavior, because that you talk a lot about too.
Right. I mean, the thing is that at this stage, during this third period of Holocaust in Poland, that's when your neighbors, your Polish neighbors, basically they have your fate in their hands. Mm. And the dynamics of these choices, horrifying sometimes choices, are also depicted on individual levels, because we are going, especially at the end of the war, if you have, let's say, in my county, you have around 15,000 Jews, at the end of the day there will be about 150 still surviving, so you can really, you can basically become acquainted with them nearly, because out of this enormous mass of people, very few, you can see how they are withering away, how they are, and you can see the situations in which, and another thing is that this work also entailed, and this is something we did, all of us, we went to these areas today, and I will be over in a second.
I just mentioned
that I'll give you an example. I was studying a county called Węgrów, which is about 50 or 70 kilometers northeast of Warsaw. Those of you who went to Treblinka was at the very northern east edge of this county, which made quite a horrifying experience, because actually writing about this county, I was crisscrossing on the bicycle and car and so on and so on, walking. And when you look at the historical evidence from Treblinka and from the immediate area around it, that was one more finding that we had and I had in the beginning, when I could see that if I were a human geographer, I would be able to pinpoint Treblinka here and then concentric circles of evil, I could call it. The radiating force of evil. How, I mean, it sounds perhaps a bit too high-minded, but the thing is that imagine you have not only this horrifying death site where 900,000 Jews have been put to death, but imagine you have trains bringing people into the camp. You have literally thousands of these Jews fleeing on the way, breaking out of the wagons. They are running away. Many Jews from Treblinka run away, and they are thought to carry gold, unfortunately. There is a real feeding frenzy in the area of miles and tens of miles around Treblinka. And then when you look at transports, Germans are evacuating to Germany trainloads of goods taken off their victims, right, in the camp. Now these trains become objects of massive thefts, which I found the traces of in German archives, investigations, mostly clothing, but not only, precious objects going from...
And they stopped so that the trains could be...
And then when you look at smaller camps here, you will see that these smaller camps also radiated their own zones of evil. So we are looking at this thing. And finally, before I stop here just in a second, the thing is that when you go to these areas, you can see that this history is not dead. It's not gone. It is like an open sore, because there are so many traumas and so many secrets which have never been vented, which have never been discussed. To give an example, one time, it's not always easy, because sometimes people can put set dogs on you if they are unhappy with what they hear, and they are most often unhappy with what they hear. But I come armed with court documents, let's say from 1945 or 46. I know the names of all these farmers. The same families are still working in the same village, in the same hamlet. For instance, went to a tiny place called Jomaki, which I described, by the way, here. With my papers from 1940s in hand, and I want to locate the family of a very courageous farmer who was actually hiding 15 Jews in his stables and barns, none of whom survived. All of them have been murdered. Half of them have been murdered by Polish blue police and the German policemen, and the other half were murdered by Polish resistance from the same village. And when I encountered this lady, she was the granddaughter of this long-deceased farmer. She knew the story. When I gave her the names, she, of course, filled in the blanks. She knew everything. And she told me that her family was ostracized for a long, long time. She told me that in the 1970s still, and in the 1980s, this tiny village was pooling their milk. In other words, they were delivering their milk. They put together and they delivered to a milk processing plant nearby, with the exception of their family's milk, because they were outside of the pale of community, because they were hiding the Jews. And when she finally, 15 years ago, constructed one more story over her house, the village went absolutely silent. Aha, so now they finally moved their Jewish gold. Because the idea that you could hide the Jews for free or somehow without compensation was exotic. Mm. So these things are not always described here, but the thing is that this history is very much alive. And when you do this kind of local research, you think to yourselves that perhaps, you know, two divisions of psychotherapists and psychologists would have a lot of work in these areas.
Yeah. There are a lot of very heartbreaking things in your book. And as a Holocaust historian, we sometimes get the question, how can you deal with these things? One of the heartbreaking things that are written or told in this book is in chapter 7, where Thomas Friedel tells about Dębica County.
Dębica County.
And in his conclusion, he talks about survival strategies and the importance of family. And he writes, quote, "A fundamental force behind the strategic aspects that cut across all class and social difference was the family." And he tells the story of Professor Emil Kortkover. and his family. He was offered the chance to escape, but he turned it down, and he tried to convince his daughter, Tosha, and she decided, no, I don't want to break the family. I'm going to go with my father, even though she understood that this meant death. So Friedel writes, quote, the Holocaust was a man-made disaster of biblical proportions, but in the General Gouvernement, there was no Noah's Ark, only small improvised rafts, most of which were destroyed in the high seas of survival in 1942-1943. Among the drowned and the saved, the individual survivors, in most cases, the sole remaining members of shattered family units, represent the end product of strategies whose core moral and strategic dilemma concerned the family. It was the most taken for granted assumption, yet the most operative factor. The dilemmas posed by the choiceless choices during the Holocaust was not between life and death, but also between life and the family. Would you want to comment on this, and would you like to perhaps say something about
just a very short thing? I mean, the thing is that the more you enter this fray, the more, of course, it sort of makes you, no, of course, profoundly sad. And the thing is that these choices are not; they are. What I ask myself and my students to do is always to place yourself in the victim's shoes. It's extraordinarily difficult, but try to feel a degree of empathy, because these choices that these people face are universal human choices. I mean, as they say in legal terms, that that hard cases make bad law, but in the Holocaust there was no other; there were only hard cases. What you can see through these pages as well is how we as human beings react under extreme pressure. So it can tell you something about yourself, hopefully only on theoretical level. Hopefully none of us will ever experience things like this. But the thing is that it's good to know, to be somehow, to brace yourself and to inquire about what makes us human. For instance, I don't want to make name names here, but one of these survivors, very often when you work with these documents, you go after, people come to you. And this generation of survivors is passing on, but there are some of them still with us. And so I meet one of my, so to say, survivors. I talk about her briefly in my previous book. And she was faced with a dilemma. It's either she will survive or her younger brother. There was no room for them in a dungeon which she was stuck, and he would cry. He was very young. This is a choice that a girl of 13 has to make. So I mean, it gives you a pause. I mean, you cannot ever pronounce moral judgments on situations like this. What a historian can do is can describe and quietly move away. That's all we can do. So this reflects the same thing.
Yeah. And the other question was about how do you manage to deal with this, and how did you meet a therapist too, or your team?
No, but I must tell you that it wears you down, and I would like very much to not to do it anymore. The thing is that there is some commitment that you have towards, I mean, I don't want to sound dramatic, but towards the memory of all these people. But the thing is that many of my good friend, for instance, Professor Jan Gross of Princeton, he said he would never write a word about it anymore. He just doesn't have any more strength, psychological resilience. I believe that each and every one of us, after, you know, if you take this as seriously as you should, if it's not a 9-to-5 job, which also happens for some people, right? Then at the end of the day, there is a point that you should not perhaps even write anymore. I believe I'm closing on this point too quite quickly.
Because the other side of it, as you were saying, there are a lot of details, and you also give a voice to a lot of these people and tell their stories, which is very moving and important. And obviously, as you were saying, you are actually also looking or making cases which we didn't know that much about before, which is very important. So you say in your book that this is about microhistory. And some would think, okay, so you talk about counties and local, but this is not local history. What's the difference between, just for everybody
right,
here, so that we
briefly,
can understand?
I mean, this microhistory is local history and more. In other words, it looks at a specific area, which local history does, but microhistory looks at people rather than places. That our primary concern is so-called human trajectories.
Yeah.
In other words, we follow people. So if they leave our area, we are taking stock of their movement. Sometimes it's possible, not always, but at least for some statistical purposes, we can. So we are following our people from the from this particular. So we're studying the local history plus the history of people who were locals, and then perhaps we're not no longer locals.
In order to tell the story.
In order to tell the story.
Yeah,
so this is this is a technique in history that historians simply, for obvious reasons, tend to prioritize people, especially in the case of study of the Holocaust.
Mm. You were saying that you were doing this sort of on very small funding. Still, this is a big group of researchers, and I was struck when I read your book that it's difficult in I would say in Sweden to get the funding for a huge project, although you can really show that it's very fruitful, and it wouldn't, as you were saying, you couldn't be criticized now because you actually have all these eight counties plus the other county,
right?
And you can say so much more, but is it easy, and do you think that...
I would never again venture into
try.
A problem. I mean, the thing is that historians' work usually is a very lonely work.
Yes.
We work alone. I mean, sometimes you work with another person, but rarely you have things of this magnitude.
Mm.
And I must tell you, as co-editor and co-author, it devoured my life. So coordinate fighting for funding is, as you know, very difficult.
Yeah.
But it was done really on a shoestring budget. And the second thing is that coordinating, producing a volume which is very unified in terms of methodology is also extraordinarily difficult because all humanists are individuals, right? And we don't take very well to any kind of frame imposed upon us. So so losing friends and in this situation is unfortunately part of the game too. Done. I am satisfied with this tremendous work, but I would never
do it again.
never decide
in
to,
this way. No, we're very glad you did because it gives us it's a very interesting book, and it gives
I mean, it's not something you would probably read from A to Z.
No,
it's rather you choose your chapters, but still, you know, they are comparable. That was the goal of it.
Yeah. So you told us in the beginning that the book was received because of the trial and everything. What about the English version now? How has it been received?
The English version took several years to have, three years to, which is sort of normal. Translation takes time and whatnot. But I must tell you that once again the politics showed its ugly face in the process. This is
Poland?
Outside. It is actually the book is published jointly by Indiana University Press and by Yad Vashem.
Mm.
And lo and behold, when the news of the impending publication has been announced or made public, which book was still in the process of being done, the Polish government sent an official letter to Yad Vashem that they protest this edition, and that if Yad Vashem goes ahead and publishes it, they request that this book contain a rebuttal at the end written by the officials of the Polish state.
A disclaimer thing or something. That's ridiculous.
But,
then,
but this reflects state of mind of people responsible today in Poland for historical memory. It is a you can say cabinet de curiosité, sort of a weird place, intellectually speaking, but still, such an attempt has been done. And how many informal pressures have been born, I can only guess. I know that even in Sweden, there was Polish embassy was very active in trying to counter my visit when I came here last time, and some articles that I published in Swedish press. So this of political pressures which have been exerted in Poland were much more, of course, dramatic, but they even showed their ugly mug in the West.
So what about your colleagues who are working in Poland, Professor Barbara Engelking, for instance, and some of the others? How are their possibilities?
For the time being, everything seems to be okay. All the half co-authors are actually, two are from Canada, one is from France. So we are, let's say, outside of the immediate danger zone. But my younger and older colleagues in Poland are all of them working in the academia, and academia unit. Big universities are still places of relative independence in Poland, which is, I stress, still. But for the time being, I am happy to report that the great majority of ad personam attacks went my way, and I am very, let's say, content to be this sort of point of taking heat off the other members of our team, which have done tremendous work. But of course, we don't know what will happen in the future because these things are ongoing. And the government now attempts to limit and restrict the independence of universities, and also the last remaining, let's say, independent grant funding. State organizations are under tremendous pressure to conform to the policies of memory of the state.
The right type of history.
But for the time being, I have not been told about any, let's say, major acts of repression.
We're glad to hear that. So you were saying you wouldn't conduct this type of project again, but what, and just in the beginning of the book, you say that we still don't know enough. We still know woefully little about what happened. If you would point to like further research, what else do we need?
I can tell you right away that in the aftermath of this work, one of the things that I found out that we know woefully little about is what happened at the lowest level of administration. For instance, what happened between the village elders and local Jews? What happened between the voits? Voit will be like a administration chief of several villages.
Right.
This is a completely untold story. And here, for instance, I found, I'm working now, my project now is about this 1939-1942, the relationships between Jewish families and communities and their, let's say, surrounding institutions on the lowest level. We know practically nothing about this, and this had a tremendous impact on everyday Jewish life before the mass murder began. And then there is the issue of Aktionen, which has not been, for instance, we don't know what happened to untold thousands of Jews who went into hiding inside the ghettos. We signal the problem. Yeah. It's a massive process. The Jews don't want to flee. As long as they can, they will try to survive hiding inside the ghettos, in hideouts, in attics. In my Węgrów that I described, it took about 1 month. There was close to 1,000 Jews out of 10 who chose this strategy because they thought that the Germans would go away and life would return to normal. Because you fall back on your previous experience, right? The pogroms or whatever it happened in the past, these acts of furious, murderous rage went away. And then people tried to pick up the pieces of their life. and no one understood that there is no life left.
Right.
And so these actions, what happened, is something that we needed to study. What happened, what was the fate of religious Jews? We know very little because practically none of them survived.
Right.
So this is my colleague Javi Dreyfus is studying now. So there is a number, and of course on the Polish side, as I mentioned, the Blue Police thing that I wrote a book recently, it's still an open field. So there is...
And a sensitive issue.
It's very sensitive because we are talking here, this new book of mine shall be out in English next year, about Polish Blue Police, which was a horrifying organization, not only because they were mass murderers of Jews, but that they did it without any German knowledge even. So the local agency was something that needs to be also described. And the list of these issues, for instance, appropriation of Jewish property. We know just pieces of it. I mean, now imagine you have ongoing murder of 3 million people. Who are basically leaving behind, if you can say so, hundreds of thousands of dwellings. What happens to these dwellings? It's the Germans don't have the manpower to sell them, to do anything with them. So these are just some questions that we're looking at this triangle between Poles, Jews and Germans that we can look. There is even more these topics to mention.
Yeah. Yeah. And you were also in the book, you talk about the merits of the long historical perspective and the pre-war context to understanding the different outcomes in different counties. Would you want to say something about the ones that were occupied by the Germans
right.
and the one that...
Oh, very briefly, I mean, these counties are very different. The thing is that one county is in the south, in the mountains, which there is a special group that I mentioned to one of you here, Goralenvolk, as the Germans said, and mountaineers, very different customs and traditions, very different Jews also. Then you have the plains and the east and north, very different areas, and you can see how this Holocaust has its horrifying way of coming to a common goal, which is total extermination of the Jews, through a variety of very different ways. So in each and every case, you will see that the German tactic is so flexible, it's not following one pattern. It will use different roads, of horrifying roads, to arrive at this common destination, and this common destination is 1% Jews who are able to survive, but in a very different circumstances. So you can see how, you can say in a way inevitable, given the completeness of the system of extermination this process was, but you can say that this drama played itself out in a variety of different scenarios. So this is what makes it also so tragically interesting, is that this inevitability at the end is being achieved or reached through a variety of very different means. For instance, if you go, it's not from this book, it's my article of mine, but if you go to a place called Markowa in Poland, it's in southeast Poland, close to Rzeszów, there is a big museum constructed 6 years ago, a museum devoted to Poles saving Jews. This is sort of a mantra in Poland now. And the museum forgets there was a very courageous family that was killed by the Germans for having harbored Jews, and Jews were killed too. But what the museum does not report is that in that particular village, 2 years before, in 1942, the Aktion, the liquidation, has been performed without even one German policeman being present. It was done through the hands of local Polish firefighting brigades. So when you look at this local scale, this horrifying drama is simply painted in so many different colors.
And is that the most sensitive issues in Poland, that the contributions you do to perpetrator research or Täterforschung, which has to do with complicity of Poles, are these the most sensitive issues?
I would say so, because in Poland, to be honest, nobody pays any attention to the Jews. This is a non-issue because there are no Jews left in Poland from statistical point of view. So nobody really cares about the Jews. Everyone cares about their own past, the national past. Mm. Well, the Germans do the same thing. I mean, in Germany, nobody really cares about the Jews. They care about their own vision of their own society seen through these books. In Holland, few people care about the Jews, but they want to know that our society did the right thing. Or in Sweden, probably the same thing too. Mm. Did we really behave or didn't we? So in Poland, it's very much the same thing, but it's much more compounded by this fact that Polish identity is built on heroism during World War II. Mm. So anything that strikes at this idea of heroic past during World War II, that's the holy of the holies. And generally speaking, and this is something that I'm writing now about an article, because this is amazing, Holocaust in Poland is not a part of Polish history. Mm. And I went to a national library just 3 days ago in Warsaw, and I simply checked out 20 or so big volumes in the history of Poland from two, and I said, okay, I'm going to count it. And the record breaking was 2009, or general history of Poland, in which there were six lines about the Holocaust. Mm. And I said that according to my humble opinion, Holocaust has been the most tragic event in Polish history. Mm. Point. Mm. But this, we are miles and miles away from recognizing that Holocaust had anything to do with Polish history.
Thank you. So I think we should now perhaps move to questions from the audience. And Lissy will help us with the microphone. Please, who would like to start? Perhaps, yes, go ahead.
Okay, thank you for a very insightful talk. I really appreciate it. I want to ask you about the sources for your work. First, were the German sources valuable and useful? Say valid. And the second is, were there any Polish sources? Was there just a complete blackout that no Poles were interested in what was going on and they just were completely silent?
Well, the thing is, the German sources are a strange bunch. They are not. The one thing is that for the post-war trials, 60s and 70s, that I mentioned, are very awkward because you can see that you have perpetrators who want to talk and you have prosecutors who don't want them to talk. It's very awkward dynamic. Sometimes these people want to come out and say, and they say, no, let's stop for today, let's reconvene tomorrow. But they still do have, if you have a number of these soldiers and policemen and local party officials, even if they lie, if you are a trained historian, you can, but then you have the whole array of German wartime files, which are interesting. For instance, I was conducting massive research into German courts from the wartime, which were untapped for Poland before I started doing it in 2001, 2002. I went with Sondergerichte, the huge courts, German courts located in Poland. And then you have German and Polish depositions of witnesses, interrogations of suspects. And these are documents which were contemporaneous. They are important because they are something, people are afraid, of course, what they say but in a court. But you can somehow, if you have masses of it, you can gauge what really has happened. So this, in terms of Polish memory, there was very little of it until we received, as historians, two-hour, perusal, these post-war records of investigations into crimes committed by people collaborating with the Germans. As I mentioned before, those are very strange files because in thousands of cases, Poles were dragged to courts in 1946, 47, let's say. They were dragged to courts because they were complicit in killing Jews or informing on Jews. And what made these court cases so extraordinary, interesting, is that I call them orphan cases. Nobody wanted these cases. Mm. It's usually the sentences were not high or nothing at all, because the communist authorities were loath to have these cases, because in Poland the story was that communists were brought to Poland by Soviets, and Soviets are Jews. So they are basically Jewish lackeys. The last thing Polish communist authorities wanted would be to confirm this, let's say, assumption by sentencing good Poles for crimes against Jews. The Jews had no voice because they were dead or gone. After Kielce pogrom in 1946, they were practically largely gone. So these cases were prosecuted without zeal at all, and you can see the thousands and thousands of testimonies of these peasants brought to court, how they spill basically their stories in front of the judge, and you can really understand so much more about these local dynamics through these court trials. Mm. Otherwise, Polish memory of the Holocaust has been cleansed. What is actually important and interesting is that once in 1960s and 70s, Germans tried to prosecute their own Tatar, their own perpetrators, Polish authorities in Poland were preparing files for them with depositions from. Now, these depositions from 1960s from Poland had nothing to do with 1940s already. They were cleansed of any shadow of local complicity. So as for a historian, it's important how a state can intervene in shaping memory also. So these are fascinating stories. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Tommy.
Hi, I'm the child of the 1%, both my mother and father survived and came here.
Oh.
And I was wondering, how would you, if you have to, if you would rate Polish General Republic, so to say, were they, didn't they know, were they banned by standards, or did they take part? I mean, what's your general conclusion of the Polish?
Well, one thing that I said in terms of general, I will never be able to assign numerical, let's say, values to how many Poles did what. We can say you can have certain feelings. One thing I decided to practically not to use is the term bystander. Instead, I'm falling back on a term coined by Dr. Janicka, who came up with the idea of, she calls it, participating observer. Mm. It gives you a degree of agency which you can use one way or another, but in terms of indifferent bystander who is basically, you know, oblivious to the event, I don't believe it anymore. Especially, you know, having done this work, you can see that everything was so public, even if there was a fence, which was not always the case. It was so public, and the suffering was so displayed to everybody that even if you, you know, withdrew, it was an act of some kind of decision, right? Moral, with moral consequences, if you refuse to acknowledge certain the existence of the suffering around you. So I tend to go with this idea of a participating observer without applying many moral markers to it. But definitely not indifference, as it's very often said. 90% had nothing to do. No, that one I would protest.
And would you want to say something about of the Poles that helped Jews, like the woman you were describing, who were ostracized and her family was
right.
Ostracized? That was a small part, but still a part of.
Oh yeah, I mean, each and every of these chapters contains discussion of people who were trying to, non-Jews who were trying to help Jews, and the thing is that analyzing these people or describing these people without describing conditions in which they performed their noble deeds is completely impossible.
The context is important.
Context all important because these people were, I mean, each and every time you have Soviet troops entering local village, let's say January 28, 1945, as it happened in each and every chapter, you can see it, the local Polish peasant or whoever it is, the rescuer opens the door to the dungeon or to a hideout or from the attic and tells his Jew or his Jews, okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. The Soviets arrived. Now off you go. Don't you ever dare to say who, where you spent last 2 years, for instance. So this is the context in which this extraordinary bravery has to be understood, because these people they were not so much fearful of the Germans, who had no clue, but they where the Jews were hidden, but they were deadly afraid of their neighbors, who could, for instance, count how many buckets of water you brought out from your well in your yard, or perhaps why would you carry a newspaper since you know you are not exactly an avid reader. In the village no one was, and if someone read, perhaps he was from a different tribe. So these things were impossible for the Germans to recognize, but they were, you know, more than open to your neighbors.
I'm
the grandchild of one of those very Orthodox religious Jewish families that survived. And it seems like from the little research I've done, they lived close to Krakow or Rzeszów, the two wine soup area.
Right.
And it seems like in the beginning of the war, the demarcation lines moved. And on the one side, the family is very religious and poor. And there, the rabbis of that community seem to have a very important role in saying, you know, go east. So basically, a whole community seems to survive because the rabbis have that foresight and tell their poor religious followers to go. Is that what your friend, your colleague is researching? Is that also part of micro history?
Javi Dreyfus is actually looking more at Warsaw, but you are right. I mean, the thing is that the initial period, the voice of a rabbi carried and had, especially in these areas that were, you know, between the Soviet and German border, after a year or two, these communities sort of collapsed under the pressure of fear and hunger very often. But in the beginning, you are quite right, this entire communities could be on the move if ordered or suggested by their spiritual leaders. But this is also one more topic that has been largely not understudied, so to say.
Yeah, is it on?
I don't think it's on.
Sure. Supposed to be on. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Now it's on.
Okay.
Thank you for the most interesting talk here. I was wondering about the direct and indirect memories of the dead. How do you practically collect those direct and indirect memories? How does it work?
Okay, direct is fairly easy. This is the diaries, for instance, of people who, as Abraham Levy, and so many of them, we have poems of Itzhak Katzenelson. I mean, but indirect is actually something that that is of a more difficult kind, but we have a lot of it. And it's, for instance, from these court cases, trials, which I mean August trials, when you have, I'm giving example, you have hundreds of or thousands of Polish peasants reporting that, you know, and then she said to me, and then they did this or that, but especially precious are these said to me, sometimes quite long citations. I even, for my own purpose, I did a special, I wanted to have a lecture for my students, but then I said no, but I don't traumatize them further. I did a list of what the Jews led to death by their neighbors. What did they want to leave as their last will, so to say? So for this kind of information, you can always find. So these are the indirect sources I mentioned, but there is more of them.
Okay, my question connects to the previous one. I just read the book by Immanuel Kassov about
Samuel Kassov
about Ringelblum's archives. And my question is, from a historical point of view, how do you value those documents? How do you value those documents?
Well, Sam Kasso, my good friend, wrote a wonderful book about Ringelblum's archive. Mm. For those of you who don't know, Ringelblum is the historian of Warsaw Ghetto who, between 42 and 43, buried about 20,000 documents in these famous milk cans under the ruins of the Warsaw Ghetto. And now, I work with these documents very often. We have now, they are available on through the internet. You can download them, even English translation, also Polish and English translation, depending on the language. And they are absolutely formidable due to their, let's say, variety of the different things. Ringelblum was a trained social historian. So for him, every piece of paper that testified to the life of so-called common people, simple people, had value. So you can find the tickets, for only tram in Warsaw Ghetto. You can find reports from the provinces. You can find Russian cards. You can find posters, paintings. You can find basically traces of, because Ringelblum said, look, we are living through an unprecedented period. Our nation is being murdered. We will be no more. What we need to leave is the evidence of this horror. So basically, he didn't know what will have value in the future. He worked as a social historian, assuming that each and every paper which refers to a condition of life and death will have. So you can find from poems, through posters, through paintings, even every kind of let's say human production, documentary production that you. So it's absolutely tremendous. And also what he did, he produced sources. In other words, he said, you will write something about this part, for instance, about hunger, and you will write something about life of a postman in the ghetto. So this is why it is so you know, a collage of different very valuable pieces of evidence.
I'm surprised that there are so few people who know about it.
Once again, I have a different vision, because for me it's like everyday's thing. But you are right; it's not something that people nowadays, due to colossal effort in Warsaw of the Jewish Historical Institute, I think that everything has been rendered into English, and it's available. Most of it is already available through the website of, at no cost, from the website of Jewish Historical Institute.
And I would say, Margit, I think there is also a difference of knowledge among scholars. I think it's very known among the public, the general public. It's not at all as known, I think.
Right. Yes, although I want to add to that there is a film, a wonderful film that it was made just about this archive. I think we showed it a couple of years ago. I think the sister.
It was by Roberta Grossman.
Right.
And
Nancy Spielberg. Yes. So very interesting. So that is a way of bringing it to the general public, I guess.
Krikanyan.
Thank you for this lecture. About my name is Christian Garner. I'm a Swedish historian, and part of my research object are Polish Jewish history. So I'm very familiar with the subject, and I especially grateful when you took distance from the expression bystander and had a participant observator instead. And I think I have read all of Jante Gross books and Mysigeva Nego by Anna Wikont and so on. All research after 1945 has been with the from the hindsight. But when you describe it and explain it, you can see for most of the Poles, especially in the countryside, it was quite self-evident or natural to just continue getting rid of the Jews. I think especially of Anna Beacon's book, Musée de Vignebo, yeah. When she starts her story already in the interwar period, I mean in the 20s, and there are even murders in the neighborhood. So my comment, or your comment on this, is that the research has had this hindrance to recognize, and I have studied the earlier periods as well. If I would stop the clock in 1939, I would say that Poland was the most anti-Semitic country in Europe, not Germany. But because of the war and the German occupation and all that, it has been, even for scholars, really hard to realize how deep-seated this anti-Semitism. And I think that, and I also followed, of course, the struggle between Barbara Engelking's and yours earlier research in 2019, 2020, from the Polish Institute of National Memory and their attacks.
Right.
And I think you have pointed to this cognitive dissonance. Yes, the Jews are after us, but we are not anti-Semites, and therefore we will not be reminded of this part. So I think you could comment on what I'm trying to make a point of.
Oh, I understand very well. I mean, thank you for this comment, and I can only wholeheartedly agree with you. And the thing is that this what the thing that we do creates this cognitive dissonance, as you said, and the consequences are dire. But I believe very strongly that the longer you live with a lie, the worse it is for you in as an individual and as a society. Mm.
Thank you again. I have a really long, a general question that's I wonder if you deal with in your book and can be answered. And that is, why did this happen? And I'm not, you mentioned, for example, there are a lot of Poles who did not need to kill the Jews. They could have disliked them or thought maybe there's something wrong with them. But actual killing, I mean, that is incredibly extreme. So I'd appreciate your comments.
Right. I mean, the thing is that, you know, the problem is that when you look at the why, there are historians who tend to give one key fit all locks answer. I'm not one of them. This is too complex a problem. But this having been said, I would say that that at the bottom of this horror is ideology of anti-Semitism that has been expressed. You can call it greed, of course, but it's not every pair of shoes that became object of desire. If they were Jewish shoes, they became, because they were basically for the taking. Why they were for the taking? Well, there you go back to ideology, which made, for instance, that every Jewish property has been a stolen property because the Jews were parasites, and so on and so forth. So when you go to this kind, you can detect these. So my answer to you is that at the bottom, if you really want to drill this question through, you will hit on various kinds of the oldest prejudice in the world, which is anti-Semitism. Mm. I mean, we don't have any other theory of hate which would span 2,000 years without any break. I would rather go this direction, although I know that it's not the only part of it, not the only answer. Mm.
Well, thank you again, but I often think about and would like to know how those Jews who flew to East, how they survived, how the population met them. Is there any study?
You mean the Jews who went to the Soviet Union?
Yeah, from Poland. They flew. My father did it.
Right,
he survived.
There is a very good study
but
published.
What happened there?
Yes, there is a very good study published a year and a half ago by Professor Adler. She's from University of Pennsylvania. A wonderful study about these 250,000 Jews. What happened to them? What were their choices? And you know, the irony of history is that Jews who went to the East and actually were later on, many of them were deported to Siberia to the slave for slave labor prisons and so on. They, at the same token, this was the trip which saved their lives because they never came under. So irony of history. But I would say the best book is by Professor Adler. I forgot the title.
Eliana Adler.
Yes. So this is an extraordinary good book published a year and a half ago. So if you want to check her out, and she will give you the panorama, so to say. But also very interesting was Jan Tomasz Gross, but this is only in Polish, about the Jews shipped to the East, but it's a fairly old book. But if you go with Adler, you won't be disappointed.
Thank you. All right, so if there are no more questions, yeah. Anneli?
So I grew up in the 90s, and I think this dichotomy, in a sense, of perpetrator, bystander, and victim was a very strong educational tool, at least in kind of Jewish informal education, to understand what took place. But you don't seem to like that.
No.
Could you say, I mean, what is a more realistic and understandable?
Well, today, if you go to the Museum of History of Polish Jews, Polin in Warsaw, you are being told that 5% helped the Jews, 5% hurt the Jews, and 90%, you know, or in between. I don't subscribe to this idea. As I mentioned, I have written extensively about it. For me, the word bystander implies a certain aloofness, detachment from the event. Now, you can have this discussion in France, in Holland, certainly in Sweden, not in Ukraine, not in Poland, not in Lithuania, definitely not in Slovakia or Romania or Hungary. So there actually where the Jews lived in large numbers, where they were, from where they were delivered to their deaths or they were put to death, there was preciously little of this bystanding possible at all. So I would here draw this distinction. Although there were very many psychological mechanisms of coping with, but it's a different story. I just recently interviewed a 93-4-year-old person I know very well, Polish lady, who lived when she was actually in herself, she was 17 or 18 when the ghetto was liquidated in a tiny place where she lived, and she told me she doesn't remember. What can I say to that? When a half of your town is being murdered, how can you not remember? What can you say? You cannot pry the door open if it remains closed. But these are coping mechanisms. In my writing, I don't use bystander anymore as a, however useful it might be in terms of education.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, then perhaps Lissy, you would want to bring the little gift thingy. Yes.
Yeah. So thank you very much, John, for this enlightening and disturbing and important talk. And thank you, Corinne, for having this discussion on this week in which we remember the November pogroms, very symbolic. We have a little gift for you. You know, we wanted to give you flowers, but you're traveling,
you don't need to.
So we have a book, Speaking Memories. It's a book of an exhibition that we had here at the museum that opened almost 4 years ago.
Lovely.
But the project Speaking Memories started in 2015. You will read all about it.
Thank you. It's also in English.
It's in English and Swedish, actually. And I think that something about that project and exhibition I think most people know it, was, if not an embryo, then it planted a seed to what now will become the Holocaust Museum in Sweden.
Oh, wonderful.
So I
thank
would
you so. Thank you so much.
It.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. And with those words, Lissy from Jewish Kultur I Sverige, Judisk Kultur I Sverige, and I, Karin Kvistgevert from the IHRS, would want to thank all of you in the audience who came here today and asked all these excellent and interesting questions, and would of course want to thank you, Jan, for coming here, for learning, getting, helping us understand this very important book. So thank you. So
thank you very much.
Warm round of applause for Jan, I think. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jan.
Thank you.
Og hermed vil jeg, Alexander Migdalslav, takke af for i aften, ønske alle en fortsat god aften og på genhør på Radio Shalom.